For the week of June 4th, 2017, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 369, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And on the island of Themyscira, I'm Michael Giltz.
I have a feeling that has to do with Wonder Woman, but really what you're talking about is the fact that somehow your microphone is missing. It's gone. It's MIA, and you're doing this show from kind of leaning over your laptop. Is that what you're referring to?
I am hugging my laptop even as we speak.
But I do that even when I'm not, you know, using it. I just hug it just to, you know, make sure it's close.
Right. And let it know that you're going to say goodbye as you buy a new Apple laptop since they had an announcement today. But anyway, I'm in Allentown, Pennsylvania, visiting my brother and his family. Then I'm going to head down south for the summer. So that's where I'm going. But I left some luggage and stuff in New York, which I'm going to go pick up tomorrow.
Well, now I wonder, whether audio quality even matters anymore, because as I watch CNN and Fox News and MSNBC, they have all of these Skype calls coming in, these Skype correspondents, and the audio is sometimes great, sometimes horrible, and it doesn't seem to matter anymore.
What matters is the content. What comes through loud and clear is, you know, knowledge and information and perspective. And that's what we provide, isn't it? What are we going to talk about this week on the show?
We're going to have some knowledge and perspective and all the stuff you just said. In fact, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're going to be looking at the dumb antics of comedian Kathy Griffin and HBO's Bill Maher. They did themselves no favors over the past week, and they are now paying the price. We'll also tell you about how and why a radio DJ who helped discover acts such as the Sex Pistols and the Ramones is leaving his weekly radio show after 40 years. During our book filter segment, Michael, you're going to talk about three new works of nonfiction that are ready for their big screen close-up. On Inside Baseball, we'll look at music, where Tidal is in turmoil and Apple is looking to make more and more revenue from content instead of computers. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the rest of the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. We're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Mojo and Profits, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, you name it. And the number one movie around the world, thanks Zeus, says Warner Brothers. Yes, it's Wonder Woman, $223 million worldwide. A very solid start for the biggest budgeted film ever directed by a woman and the film with the biggest North American debut weekend of all time ever directed by a woman.
Yeah, now, did you see the film?
I did, actually. I saw it over the weekend, and I'm fascinated by your 3D information you're going to have for us in a second, because I actually noted that when I was picking up tickets that there were, at the screening I was at, there were two screenings in 3D and about 14 in 2D. So this did not seem to be a player at all in North America in terms of 3D, but that's certainly not the case in the rest of the world.
Well, yeah, okay, so since you brought it up, let's cover that ground first. So yes, internationally, I mean, you go to China and it's 100% of the gross. Here in the U.S., I bought my tickets very late for a screening of Wonder Woman on Sunday, and there were four seats left in the entire auditorium. It was a 2D showing. But initially I thought, oh wow, look, this whole auditorium is completely open. This is great. I didn't realize that what I was looking at was a 3D screening.
Ha.
So of course, by the time of the showing on Sunday, you know, people were left with only the 3D showing to view. So they, I guess, by default, had to go pay for a 3D ticket. But in the United Kingdom, it was 23%. In Russia, it was 46%. Brazil...
Whoa, 23% in the UK, that's very low.
That's very low. Russia...
But that's what we had about in North America.
Right. Brazil, 79%.
Yeah, okay, yeah, we know. In a lot of the world, it's 3D is very popular. What was the total gross worldwide from 3D?
43%. So 43% of the $223 million earned by Wonder Woman over the weekend came from 3D showings. I guess my whole point in bringing up all of that was, I wonder how much of that percentage was people who were forced to see it in 3D.
Well, you had no choice in China, right?
Well, that's true, yes.
And that was a solid, I'm not sure what the final figures were from China, but I know, I think on opening day or something, it was $12 million. So that's obviously a good chunk right there. But in North America, one out of $4 was spent on 3D. That means probably about 20 to 22% of the tickets were sold in 3D. So maybe four out of five people went to see it in 2D. That's clearly the preference in the US, clearly the preference in the UK. And I think we're going to slowly see those numbers come down in the rest of the world.
Well, okay, you asked about how much money Wonder Woman had made in China. It was $38 million over the weekend.
All right. I thought the movie didn't suck. It was better than the other DC movies, if you want to rate it on a sliding scale, but I still don't think it was a good movie, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, look, I thought it was more enjoyable than, as you mentioned, Michael, like, say, Superman or Batman versus Superman and all of those other
Zack
Snyder.
Suicide Squad, there's only one other.
Yeah, okay, well, I thought it was actually, for that kind of movie, semi-enjoyable. I enjoyed it, actually. And I, of course, I went in thinking, another one of these movies, but came out going, oh, okay. It was done with a little bit of style and a little bit of flair. And so that I liked about it. It was way too long, but...
Yeah, no, I disagree. I mean, I give it 2 stars out of 4. It's not a good movie. I don't think, well, it's a superhero movie, therefore I don't expect it to be good. I expect every movie to be good. You know, Ant-Man was better than this. Captain America Part 2 was better than this. Obviously Spider-Man with Tobey Maguire. I mean, these can be great. There's no reason you can't make a great Western or a great superhero movie. And just because this one wasn't as bad as the others, there's no reason to pretend it was good. It's not good. It's a bad movie.
Okay. If you think that's a bad movie.
It's a bad movie. I thought it was better than Guardians of the Galaxy 2. Big deal. That movie was dreadful. That movie was just they all needed therapy. It was unbelievable. Every character stated their internal, you know, I have sister issues. I have daddy issues. It was like, shut up and go to a psychiatrist.
Spoiler alert.
It's a joyless movie, a joyless film, really. That was a dreadful movie. I can't believe people went to see that. This one is a lot more fun. It's not bad. The first half is better than the second half. I really thought everything with the gods was confused. Who has what powers? You know, it's just no fun when you don't know what the rules are. And they failed to set up the rules for Diana. And who she is and what she can do.
Right.
So you don't know she's vulnerable. So it's boring watching God smash at each other with a Jeep. You think, well, that's not going to work.
Wait, so you're saying in the second part of the movie where that does happen. And by the way, that's not a spoiler. It's a superhero movie. You kind of know that's going to happen in the second part of the movie. It comes with the territory. And I agree with you. As I was watching it, I thought to myself, you know, that's the problem with these movies these days. It's like when you can pick up a tank and just throw it across the room, that's a problem, because then anything is possible, and therefore there is never any jeopardy.
Well, more importantly, there's just very poor character development beyond the two leads. All the sidekicks in the movie, there's a Native American character, there's a sharpshooter, and there's an actor who helped them on their mission in World War I. None of them are well developed. I won't spoil the movie, but it's like character arc 101 is not attempted with these people. It's ridiculous. There's a quirky secretary back in England, who's a funny actress, delivers her lines amusingly. She has absolutely nothing to do. Nothing. And it's just, again and again, they drop the ball. You know, I thought the beginning on the island was okay. I thought the early stuff in England was pretty good. They didn't overplay her fish out of water status or make her the butt of jokes. But then as the mission continued and the movie went on, I thought it got less and less interesting. The showdown between the big villain and her, I found boring.
Yeah, I agree with you. I did like all of the kind of backhanded commentary on modern society about, oh, well, you have this little wristwatch, and so it tells you what to do and when to do it because of what's on your wristwatch. Well, we call that slavery. You know, it's like, I just thought that was, you know, all of these little comments.
Pulse.
Yeah, it had a pulse, as you say. The banter between Chris Pine and Gal Gadot. Mm-hmm. I've heard it pronounced both ways. She's an Israeli actress who plays Wonder Woman. I kind of enjoyed that. But yes, I completely agree with you that as it progressed, the film became less interesting. I would also point out to what you were saying, and I know this is not a film review show, but the whole point of that you were making about not knowing what the rules are, that was kind of inherent in the way Wonder Woman was set up, her mythology of not knowing who she was, at least in this particular film.
Right, but that's poor writing. There's no we can know the rules eventually, so that we can know if you know what's going on. So eventually, you have to find out so you know what's happening.
Right, or yeah, we can know, and
she finds out she's a god, and she kind of brushes it off. Like, that would give me pause.
Right,
and everybody else. This is a woman who jumps into a bell tower. I don't think she does heroic feats, so it's not a spoiler. Jumps into a bell tower like 100 feet up in the air, smashes it to pieces, and all the villagers and her companions are like, oh yeah. Nobody says anything like, holy moly, my god, she's a superhero.
Right.
Nobody says anything. It's ridiculous.
You know what was really ridiculous? Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Tell No Tales, which I could hear through the theater wall at the cinema I was at.
Well, Pirates of the Caribbean is grossed $95 million worldwide, and it passed the $500 million mark, but it needs to, because it's an awfully expensive movie to make. And the perception, of course, is that the Pirates movies have been, you know, bad for a while, but the last two grossed $1 billion. Is the perception that this one is a flop or is not successful? It's certainly falling hard in North America, but if it ends up making $800 or $900 million, it's going to be a, you know, commercial success.
Yeah, I mean, how long has this movie been out? It's been out 1 week, right? So this is, it was in its second week. Captain Underpants beat it this week, okay?
Well, God, you know, hey, let's not knock a good kid's book. But yes, that's in North America, Captain Underpants beat it. But yeah, that's not the, you know, if you make $1 billion your first week and $4 the second, who cares where or how you make your money beyond the exhibitors and all their contracts. But yeah, the point is, where does it end up? And that's the perspective, the perception game that Wonder Woman was playing. Warner Brothers had an absurdly low opening weekend prediction of $65 million, right? Everyone was like, that's not even close. It's going to do more than that.
Yeah, well, I think they're trying to downplay the fact that some of their previous superhero movies didn't necessarily work.
No, they had huge opening weekends, but they were saying this is not going to be as big as Batman and Superman, because Superman is Superman, and Batman is Batman, the most successful superhero franchise in the movies of all time. So do not place Wonder Woman in that same category. She didn't come even close to what Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman did on opening weekend. But she's going to have better legs. You know, what matters is not where you begin, but where you end.
You see, now that's sexist. Here you are talking about Wonder Woman's legs. Unbelievable.
Well, let me talk about Zac Efron's abs, because those were the stars of Baywatch. It's grossed $32 million over the weekend, and it's just about hitting $70 million worldwide.
Which is its budget, by the way.
Yeah, so not a great start. We'll have to see if it plays overseas.
I love the fact that the head of marketing at Paramount was like, yeah, I guess we underestimated how much critics would matter on that film. It's like, yeah,
They didn't matter. It's not a critics movie as such, but they want to blame Rotten Tomatoes for not doing well. That's not the point. I don't think it needed, audiences had to like it, not critics.
Yeah.
At number four is Captain Underpants, the first epic movie. $24 million over the weekend, beating, as you point out, Pirates of the Caribbean, at least in North America. At number five is Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, which probably has to go into therapy after the comments I made about it. $14 million over the weekend, $816 million worldwide. So slowing down a bit as it tries to get to that $1 billion mark. Right now, it doesn't look like it's going to make it, but maybe there are some big territories still to come.
You know what Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 says, Michael? They say, hey, you know what? You can say anything you want about me at $816 million. I'm fine.
Yeah, no, it's grossed more than the original, both in North America and overseas. At number six is the Indian film Dangal, $8.8 million on the weekend. It's past the $250 million mark. At number seven, a movie that got good reviews and good buzz and good attention, but has not delivered at the box office, is Alien Covenant. $7 million over the weekend, $173 million worldwide. It needs to kind of double that in order to match its budget, you know, to be considered a success story right off the bat, because it cost $100 million to make. So somehow, Prometheus made more money, and that, I think, damaged the franchise enough that even though they delivered this time, audiences weren't showing up.
Do you think it's because, at this point, let's face it, people feel as if they've seen the movie already? I mean, how many Alien movies can you have before people say, hey, I saw that in 1977 or 79, whenever the original came out. I've seen it, you know, five times since then, and here's another one.
Well, they're making it for the people who weren't born when the original came out, maybe. But yeah, you know, it's, you want to be fresh and original, but it got good reviews, so people felt like it had reinvented itself or had done a good job. I don't think it was so much franchise fatigue as the fact that the last one was so bad. And number eight is King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, $4.8 million on the weekend, $130 million worldwide. And number nine is our first international, second international film, right? We already had Dangal. So here's another one. This is a Korean film. It's called Warriors of the Dawn. It grossed $4.1 million on its opening weekend. It's a period war film. It's set in the 1500s, and a newly crowned prince leads sort of mercenary soldiers to fight the invading Japanese. So yet another Korean film that will not play well in Japan. The soldiers are proxy soldiers, meaning like, I'm rich, I don't want to go to war, so I pay some peasant to take my place for me. So you've got the rough and tumble peasants, and you've got the crown prince working together to defeat the bad guys. And it stars Yao Ginju, who is a very attractive young actor. I looked up his credits when I was looking at this movie, wondering who he was. He has played so many roles as like the little brother or a famous person in their young age on TV and movies that his nickname is Nation's Little Brother, which I just love. I think that's great. And number 10 is another Japanese. This is a Japanese film. It's Doraemon, Great Adventure in the Antarctic. It's a sci-fi animated flick. It's the 37th in the franchise. It made $3.9 million on this weekend. I'm not sure what new country it opened up in, but its total is $54 million worldwide. Scrolling down for something new, we have one more movie, I think. Two more movies. Marie Francine is a French comedy that opened up. It's about an older woman falling in love with a chef, and it's directed by another woman, Valerie Le Mercier, so good for them. That goes to $1.9 million. And down at number 21, we have a Chinese comedy. This is Beautiful Accident. It's about a successful single female lawyer who gets in a car accident, and that sends her in an alternate life where she's a housewife, the mom of two kids with a demanding architect husband. I'm sure she learns a lot about the importance of family and not to place career ahead of relationships, and I'm pretty sure it won't travel well to North America.
Wait a second. I think it's already played in North America as Sliding Doors and The Family Man.
Exactly. But it sounds also like it's a little retrograde in its social politics.
Oh, maybe. Yeah, that might be true.
So Wonder Woman is still, 3D is working for Wonder Woman overseas, and that's still a big marketing tool. I guess you get the sense looking at Mexico and Hong Kong and the UK that we're seeing some mature markets where it's starting to fade a bit like it is in North America. It's always going to be a player, especially for big popcorn movies, but it's not going to be the 50, 60, 70, 80% we saw for Avatar and things like that.
Yeah, correct. Except for movies like an Avatar or where it is, or A Life of Pi, where they basically say, look, we made this movie specifically in 3D. This isn't an afterthought. It's not like we're just tacking it on so that we can get extra money. This is a 3D film from start to finish with Life of Pi and Avatar, though that was kind of one of the ways you had to see the movie. In most instances, you know, Wonder Woman, I didn't care whether I saw it in 3D or not.
I did. I didn't want to.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, who wants to put on the glasses? They didn't put thought into 3D. It wasn't the way it was sold. It wasn't shown that way to critics. So, like you say, if they tell me I need to see it in 3D because that's their artistic choice, then I will do it. Or if people say, oh my God, the 3D is so well done. But when it's an afterthought or just something to sell a couple extra bucks on a ticket, why would you want to?
What's pretty remarkable to me, 3D or not, is that really the director, Patty Jenkins, has made one film before. And it's remarkable that a studio would say, oh, you made a really good independent movie. It cost $100,000. Yeah, why don't we give you like $170 million? You go off, you make Wonder Woman. How about that?
Well, they've been doing this with a lot of their franchises, but it tends to be people who've made some sort of genre flick or some movie that has some sort of special effects element that would indicate. Or why they would choose someone like Patty Jenkins who did Monster, I don't know, but it paid off. Do we know why she didn't make a movie since then? Was she working in TV, or she just didn't have the right property, or what was going on?
Well, it looks like she worked in TV, but only in off episodes. So, you know, here's the, you know, the episode of Arrested Development, or
she kept busy. She kept busy.
Yeah, you know, certainly not nearly as much as she could have been if she had directed entire series. I have not read up. I know she was in on the cover of The Hollywood Reporter, and there's been numerous interviews with Patty Jenkins over the past week. I have to read some of them because I am wondering if maybe she was making a film that got shut down. And because of that, you know, she lost a good chunk of time.
Yeah, I mean, something was going on. I know she's made TV movies, she's done stuff, but I'm still not clear as to why that. But it's good of them to pick her up on her. So they made a plan. They wanted a good, talented director. They thought it through, and they stuck to their plan. Unlike some television personalities who just do things off the cuff and pay the price.
Well, yeah, okay. So now I'm going to stick with the television personality who did something off the cuff, a comedian who said something in a live broadcast, and you know what? You can't always be funny. Some of your jokes won't always land, but when that joke doesn't land, and it also happens to be a bit offensive and a bit of a racial slur, you get into real trouble. I'm being sarcastic, okay? I'm being, ironic maybe. I'm talking about Bill Maher, who has a show here in the United States on HBO. It's on Friday nights. It's live. It's kind of a political comedy You know, Ann Coulter has been on the show for ages. I don't know whether she still is, but
not for a while.
I didn't think so. Kellyanne Conway had been on the show numerous times, actually, before she started working with the president. And so, you know what? He's kind of known as a caustic comedian, Bill Maher, and social commentator. And this time he used the N-word while talking to Ben Sasse, a Republican representative in the House of in Congress. And he was taken to task for it.
Well, you know, I heard he used a racial slur in his show, and I clicked on the link expecting to defend him. I figured, all right, he's talking about race. He's talking about rap music. He's talking about something of substance. And he felt like it would be a two-year-old for him to say the N-word rather than the actual racial slur that he was discussing. And I thought, all right, I'm sure. And I clicked on it, and it was this completely gratuitous use of house slave versus field slave in a story not about race, not about prejudice, not about discrimination, not about rap music or anything to do with a reason why you might conceivably justify using that racial slur in context of talking about it. Instead, it was something entirely different, and the guest said, hey, you want to come out in the field with us, meaning look into this problem. And Bill Maher just riffed off the word field and said, excuse me, Senator, I am a house slave, not a field slave, and I'm not going to do that. But he used the racial slur in doing it. So, you know, I wanted to defend him, but it was gratuitous and dumb and had nothing to do with race, so it's indefensible.
Yeah, I mean, certainly it is one of those moments where you go, you know what? Okay, nope, you can't use it that way. Sorry.
And he apologized, which he rarely does. And he said, you know, I shouldn't have used it. It was wrong.
Yeah. Now, somebody else apologizing this week was Kathy Griffin. And she's a comedian, for those of you outside the U.S. I don't know whether she's very popular outside the U.S., but she's kind of...
Most comedians aren't.
Yeah, for obvious reasons. It's a very language-driven art form. And she's kind of known as being a fiery redhead who kind of take no prisoners, insult everyone, offend everyone. Well, this time she kind of did do that. She offended everyone, maybe even herself.
Well, she did a photo shoot with this artist, and in the photo shoot, they had a head of Donald Trump, and it looked like she was holding up a bloody stump of his head as if he'd been beheaded. And she holding it up online in a picture, playing off the idea of Trump saying she was bleeding out of her whatevers in an interview in a debate where he was the moderator was
Megyn Kelly. Yeah.
And so they said that this was what they were playing off of. Obviously, beheading has aspects of dictators and kings and monarchs and rulers of tyranny, as opposed to, say, holding a gun to his head. It was a very serious thing. It was not like, oh, haha, look at this. It wasn't, you know, preparation for a haunted house at Halloween. There was no context other than just her standing there sternly looking out in this photo shoot, holding a bloody head of Donald Trump as if he'd been beheaded. That went up online, and, you know, within minutes, everybody criticized her, right?
Well, everybody, including CNN, and she works for them on New Year's Eve. She does the New Year's Eve show. It's about 3 or 4 hours long, and it's with Anderson Cooper. It's been kind of a mainstay for years. And what I thought was interesting was they must not have liked that show anymore, because it's May, okay, or that at, you know, the beginning of June, they were CNN immediately came out and said, oh, nope, she's fired. It's like, okay, you couldn't wait until like October to say, yeah, you know what, we're not going to do that this year with Anderson Cooper and Kathy Griffin.
They didn't fire Anderson Cooper. He's still doing it.
No, but then, yes, but I guess I looked at it and went, why in the world did they have to make that statement? CNN wasn't a part of this story at all. And they kind of came out and I guess, were they losing sponsors?
They wanted to distance themselves from her. It's one of her big events annually. You know, she just stand up, and then they felt like they were associated with her and that she was a signature person for them, and they wanted to stay up. I felt like they could have just said, we're going to look towards this and see what happens, and we're concerned. And they could have waited to either dump her or to say it had blown over. But no, they didn't. She paid a price. And, if you're a progressive, it was nice to see everybody criticize her. Anderson Cooper, her friend, said he was appalled by it. You know, people didn't say, oh, she's a comic, she's pushing the line, it was a mistake, but she meant, everyone said appropriately, you don't make jokes about killing the president. Chelsea Clinton, everybody on the left criticized her, along with, of course, the people on the right, and said it was wrong. Within the hour, she apologized. She shot a video online, asked the artist to take down the photograph, and she said, she didn't say, oh, I'm sorry if you were offended, or I was trying to make a political point and I pushed too far. She just said, no, it was wrong and I shouldn't have done it.
And this is Kathy Griffin you're talking about.
That's correct. She said it was wrong and I shouldn't have done it. And she didn't say, I'm sorry you were offended, or, well, this is what I'm trying to do. She just said, it's wrong. I didn't mean to encourage violence. That's like, obviously I don't do that. This was wrong. It was a mistake. I made it. I was wrong. Wrong, wrong, wrong. So she lost the CNN show. She lost a sponsorship deal that she had. Some live comedy dates were canceled. And that's kind of where it should end. You know, people make mistakes, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Unfortunately for her, it will, you know, she kind of said, because the president came out and singled her out and was going after her on Twitter, you know, it will probably ruin her career. I don't know whether that's true or not, and time will tell. But I think, look, both Bill Maher and Kathy Griffin apologized. I don't think it's any reason to fire Bill Maher from his show. HBO said, kind of came out and did not stand by him. They said, we are editing that segment out of future airings of the episode.
Because I don't think that's not standing by him. They said he made a mistake and we're not going to include that mistake in future things of it.
Okay.
Not standing by him would be to fire him. I think they said they denounced the comment there. I don't think that's abandoning him.
Okay, fair enough. I would agree with that then. You know, because he doesn't deserve to be fired. It was a mistake. He's a comedian. And guess what? Comedians will do that. They can't be funny 100% of the time. Just like every athlete can't kick a goal every time their foot touches the ball or hit a home run every time they swing a bat. You know what? This is one of those moments where he went in the wrong direction.
Well, his job is to be provocative, and he does it a lot, and he does try to push buttons, and he does try to say things, and he was fired from ABC for doing the same thing, talking about the terrorist attacks on 9/11. This one doesn't rise to that level. I speak as a white man, of course, but, you know, this is a play off a phrase that people are familiar with. He was not using it in a racially antagonistic negative sense either. He was playing off a phrase that was known. He wasn't referring to people in that way. He was, you know, making a play off between house slave versus field slave, which is an idea and concept that people are now a little bit familiar with, whereas 30, 40 years ago, most white people and perhaps most black people would not have had a clue. But it wasn't used in a in sense of being negative or calling somebody that phrase. It was using a phrase that you shouldn't have, but it was not used in a negative, nasty, pointed remark about black people. Kathy Griffin, on the other hand, she's just showing the president with his head being beheaded, and that's just wrong. So she's paying a much bigger price. And I think that's appropriate. But some people are like, she's treason. She should be in jail. That's absurd. And the president's absurd for commenting on her because the president gets criticized 8 times a day and twice on Sunday. And the idea that he would weigh in on a comic is absurd as well.
Well, yeah, one would hope that the president of the United States is a little too busy to be worried about what comedians are saying about them.
Exactly.
I, on the other hand, always have time for a good book because it is time for our Book Filter segment. Book Filter is a book lover's best friend. And Michael, every week you pick one or two, or in this case, 3 books that not only we should be reading, the listeners and myself, but also maybe some books that Hollywood and the world of theater should be paying attention to because they can be turned into another good play, musical, TV show. What do you have for us this week?
I've got 3 different books that make great projects, I think. And this is a big week for books because it's the Book Expo of America, where the whole industry gets together in New York City at the Javits Center for 2 days. Publishers and publicists and booksellers and librarians and agents and everybody gets together. And then for another 2 days, we have BookCon, in which the public is invited, and they sort of try to do what Comic-Con does for comic books. They do that with books. Lots of women, lots of teenage girls. That's like 80, 90% of the audience coming to BookCon are women. So that's interesting to
see.
Wait,
where is this again? Where is the...
Is it New York City?
No, I just... And what day is that?
They're mostly teenage girls.
Oh, friend, never mind.
Yeah, and their moms. So yeah, calm down. So BookCon came back to New York last year. The Book Expo and BookCon were in Chicago. Coming back to New York, about 20,000 people showed up, which is nothing near what Comic-Con does, but it's a growth of like 10% over what they did the last time they were in New York. So it continues to grow and build. I don't want it to become like Comic-Con where it feels like the whole point is the movies and TV shows, but there is a lot of room for growth in that area. They don't have anything connected to movies or TV shows when half of those are based on books to begin with. So there's a lot of that more pop culture stuff to happen, but I love the fact that they're focused on authors and book signings and readings, but they need more readings and book signings. They just have a They have a lot of giveaways and stuff. And I felt like it's got to take a big leap forward next time, you know, have some big events and big stars to really draw them in.
Are you going to this? Are you going to be there? Because let's face
it. No, it was last weekend. It just ended.
Okay. Oh, you were there because Book Filter, being a book lover's best friend, one would think you would literally just take your sleeping bag and camp out.
That's right. I was there and people just hugged me and thanked me for all the work that I do. So those people, the industry people that were there, I'm sure pitched these books to Hollywood all the time. We've got three great books that would make good movies, I think. One is The Trial of Adolf Hitler. It's a work of history about the attempt Hitler made to start like an uprising, and it was a complete collapse, and he got arrested. The Nazis were over. It was done with, and he went to trial and gained so much attention, and media came from all over the world for this trial of this uprising in Germany. And he was so magnetic and hateful and charming and horrifying that he became a political figure because of the trial for his, you know, disastrous coup attempt. And that's what sort of put him on the road to leading the country.
Well, at least, you know, things like that, that kind of history has prevented us from repeating it in the modern. Oh, never mind.
Yeah, so it's a fascinating part of his history that you don't see covered a lot in all the books and movies and things done on World War II. And it sounds like a rising from the ashes of defeat to become, you can see the future Führer in what he does and says. So I think that's a really cool, interesting project.
I think people forget that he was in prison in 10 years before his rise.
Oh, absolutely. At number two is Watching Porn. This is a nonfiction work by a female journalist who was out of school. She had an English degree. She couldn't make any money. Somebody asked her, did she want to review this, like, this adult film for their magazine/website? And she said, oh, golly, all right, make a few bucks. It'll just be a one-off thing. And before you knew it, she's reviewing movies. She's interviewing stars. And she spent quite a few years in the adult film industry. And her story about what it's like and the disconnect between the people and what they do on screen and how people view it and how widespread it is. Kind of a really fun insider's glimpse into that world.
I noticed that the author has decided that she, like Madonna, will only go by one name.
Well, she uses an initial, Lindsay G, so she doesn't mention her last name. So that shows a little timidness where she perhaps shouldn't be. But at number three, my third choice of the week, I think this is really cool. It's a paperback original, just like the one I mentioned last week. It's called Ultimate Glory, and it's about Ultimate Frisbee. It's about one of the main athletes and stars of the Ultimate Frisbee world back when nobody paid attention to it, and they barely do now. But now it's pretty well-established, you know, sport with tournaments and stuff all over the world and lots of events. And this is about the early days in the 80s when these fanatics just were crazy about Ultimate Frisbee and just did whatever they could. And this guy was young, and he's like, I want to be one of the greatest Ultimate Frisbee players of all time. And he just became obsessed with it and devoted his life to it. And I think it's a really cool, fun story set in a sports world, but one that we don't see. And it's not a Vince Vaughn jokey type thing. I think it's a fun, cool underdog scrappy, you know, and they're all doing drugs and having fun, I'm sure, along the way. But I think that's a really cool tale, and I think it'd make a really good movie.
So what you're saying is it's not Dodgeball necessarily. It's more Rocky or
exactly.
Or yeah, Rudy, that kind of movie.
Exactly. I think, you know, if they make it right, it seems like a cool property and a cool story. ESPN could make an original film about it, or it could go, you know, be a movie in theaters. But if it works, it'd be a big deal.
Oh, wait. I just heard two words put together. It works. Oh, wait, no. Maybe it wasn't those two. Maybe it was the words big and deal, because it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story: pop music reigned in Manchester, England on Sunday night, even as the United Kingdom reeled from another low-tech terrorist attack, killing some 7 people and injuring dozens the day before. Also, by the way, a major German music festival was evacuated after it received a threat which proved false. Okay, so nonetheless, Ariana Grande, Coldplay, and many other musicians and artists performed a benefit show to help the survivors, their families, all while demonstrating they won't cave into fear. The concert was broadcast live and streamed around the world on major networks and websites. It raised $12 million so far. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think it was, I hate when they say actors or musicians are brave for doing this. But, you know, it was brave to put on the show right after what happened. And I think it was great of them all to do it. And it was the right thing to do. And it sends a great positive message to the world. So I was glad to see it.
You know, you... You know you have a problem when you're doing a benefit concert for a terrorist act that happened like 2 weeks ago, and there's already another terrorist attack that might prevent your benefit concert from occurring.
Though I think John Oliver took the media to task. I forget who had the headline, you know, England reels. He's like, we're not reeling. It was a nasty, hateful thing, but people are going along with their lives and they are not acting like the world has ended and they're not freaking out. They are behaving appropriately because there's nothing you can do about something as low tech as some idiot grabbing a car or van and driving into a crowd. That is literally something that can never be prevented. If some hateful or psychotic person wants to do that, they'll be able to do that from now until the end of time. There's no way to prevent that. But you can do other things and smart things and behave appropriately and not destroy your freedoms and life just because of individual hateful acts like that. And so he said, you know what, we're not reeling. So cut with the, you know, catastrophes talk.
Apparently, Israel and the Palestinians, they're at war. Okay, FYI. That's the implication of a court ruling. NBC Universal said their insurance for a rocket attack interrupting production in Israel was an act of terrorism, and they deserved to be compensated by the insurer. That company said it was an act of war, simmering for decades, wholly predictable, and one that required insurance from acts of war, not terrorism. The court agreed with the insurer that the situation was more an act of war than isolated terrorism. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I love court cases that end with like going to the dictionary to look at the meaning of a word. Like, what does war mean versus terrorism? The third definition says this. I think it's a big whoop. I think in general, it's just, hey, how much coverage did you pay for? It sounds like one of those things where you had hurricane insurance, but you didn't have flood insurance. You know, like the hurricane didn't destroy your house, but the flooding did. And therefore, the hurricane caused the flooding, but nonetheless, it's not covered. So it sounds like they had terrorism insurance, but they didn't have war insurance. Who knew they had war insurance? I had no idea such a thing was available.
And I didn't dive into this story deep enough to find out whether the kind of ongoing conflict between Israel and Palestine and the Palestinians is actually considered a war, because there are, you know, when you declare a war, it's a very specific thing. And so I don't know whether that's a declared war or whether it's just an ongoing conflict. Certainly it's the latter, but I don't know whether it actually is formally the former. I was totally expecting you to say something about my use of formally the former.
I didn't know what to say.
But in any case, Megyn Kelly, she's a journalist, and she went up against a rerun of 60 Minutes on Sunday, so that should be really easy, but she lost. She improved significantly on Dateline from a year ago, ranking third in viewers and second in key demos, so Kelly has a lot of ground to make up. The reviews of the show itself were also mixed, seeing it as a 60 Minutes light in terms of TV, while journalists pilloried her poor questioning of the show's big get, Vladimir Putin. I think it was just her Russian, actually, wasn't good enough. Nonetheless, NBC plans to seek a massive ad rate hike for the deeply discounted third hour of the Today Show that she'll be hosting in the mornings. I guess that'll start in the fall. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. I don't think you should make any big pronouncements based on one night, but it was against a rerun. Presumably her show could get better. I do think it would make more sense to move it somewhere other than opposite 60 Minutes. You know, there's a need for good, solid primetime journalism. Why, you know, go up against that behemoth? It just seems like a bad choice. And I'm also sort of very question marking what's going to happen with the Today Show. Why they're screwing with something that doesn't need to be fixed is beyond me.
Well, and I don't necessarily know that debuting your show in the summer is really all that, you know. Why?
Well, they wanted to get sampling. They wanted to establish themselves before going up against new episodes. So, you know.
Okay. Well, okay. Fair enough. I'm sure. Look, you know, that's why I don't work at NBC. I'm not a network executive. But if I were, I might agree with this next story. Bill O'Reilly is not having a good time. Weeks after being dumped by Fox News for decades of sexual harassment claims and payouts of tens of millions of dollars to buy off women who sued over his behavior, he's getting more bad news. The Fox-controlled National Geographic Network has canceled plans to turn his nonfiction book, Killing Patton, into a TV movie project. Execs said they couldn't crack the code of a workable script and had to reluctantly move on, which is in stark contrast to the first four movies they made from his books, including Killing Reagan, Killing Kennedy, Killing Lincoln, and that holiday favorite, Killing Jesus. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just another problem for Bill O'Reilly to deal with, but it is significant. I mean, their earlier movies have been the highest rated movies in the channel's history, which isn't saying a lot because they haven't done a lot of movies, but they've also gotten Emmy nominations. So them dumping this at this stage when they didn't need to make a choice right now, that's a big blow. You know, that's pretty well removed from what he was doing as a TV commentator. So to have a thing about Patton not happen on the National Geographic Channel just because it was associated with Bill O'Reilly, that's a problem for him.
Hey, Michael, you know what the hackers said over the weekend?
No, what?
We're back! The online criminal dubbed The Dark Overlord has officially moved on from medical records to movies. Hey, it's more fun, let's face it. First, they tried to blackmail vendors, and now they're targeting studios directly. They released most of the new season of Orange is the New Black. Now they've dumped episode of Steve Harvey's upcoming game show, Funderdome. Not Thunderdome, but Funderdome. Funderdome. Get it? No word on which studios, if any, are paying up. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. You know, people hacked it. They've got it. They're going to release them. What matters is, will it affect the ratings? Will the studios cave and pay? Which I think, hopefully, at least publicly, they're saying they won't. Maybe privately they're doing something else, but I think that'd be a mistake. Take the bullet on one or two projects. Otherwise, you're going to get hacked from now until the end of time.
Yeah, I think, first of all, trying to make vendors pay up, you know, these post-production companies.
They've got no money.
They have literally no money. I mean, these studios and networks squeeze these vendors to within an inch of their life. They basically are doing this with a margin of 1.5%, 2%. So
I know a friend who is in editing, we won't say who, but they got attacked and they got blackmailed and they paid up. They had to get access to that material. They had a client and they needed to do it. So, you know, it doesn't always fail.
Now, why did actor T.J. Miller leave the HBO sitcom Silicon Valley? We talked about it last week, and we have a listener email, actually, about it. He broke his silence when interviewed by Larry King. Miller's spin? It's not good to be complacent. You've got to challenge yourself. It'll be good for the show to shake things up. 4 years is long enough, and so on. That's all the stuff he said. He at least avoided any hints of tension on the set or personal problems, unlike myself last week. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Larry King? Larry King got him? Larry King is still doing stuff for him? Who cares about TJ Miller? Larry King landed the interview for what website or world? God bless him. You know, he's still around. And how TJ Miller decided that was where he wanted to talk. I just love that. That was very fun. But I do like this email from listeners, which I think put a good spin on why you might have had that impression about him.
Yeah, Gabrielle Thomas from Las Vegas wrote into dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You want me to read this, Michael?
Sure.
Well, Gabrielle writes, "Hey guys, I was listening to your speculation on last week's show about why TJ Miller might be leaving HBO's Silicon Valley after 4 seasons. Sperling, you said there might be more behind the news than simply an actor looking to pursue bigger projects with a higher profile and larger salary. You suggested the real reason might be a personality conflict and or drug or alcohol issues. Michael, you rightly felt that without any hard proof of such issues, the two of you shouldn't be perpetrating rumors." I'm going to correct Gabrielle here. It was really only me that was perpetrating that rumor. Okay. Gabrielle goes on to write, "However, I have to say that in this instance, maybe the reason Sperling raised the point is because so much of TJ Miller's persona is as a heavy user of drugs and alcohol. This is a reputation he has perpetuated with funny short films like Successful Alcoholics and in multiple interviews. Just this year, he told Popular Science he smokes more marijuana than his Silicon Valley character and that he's wondering if that's becoming a problem."
He can't remember.
He can't remember, but he thinks it's really funny. Other actors have also discussed getting high with Miller in their own interviews. So you're right about not wanting to spread gossip, but when it comes to the subject of TJ Miller and alcohol or drug use, he kind of brings it on himself. Love the show, Gabrielle Thomas from Las Vegas.
Yeah, well, thanks for writing in. You know, I don't know nothing about him, and I've never watched the show. So actually, I didn't know he had that persona. So I really appreciate you letting us know. And that does make sense that if that's what he's always sort of goofing off on, that you might have it in the back of your head somehow that it's actually real and there may be a problem.
Right. Well, and he kind of has joked. I've seen him, I don't want to say perform, but he's hosted the Golden Trailer Awards a couple years ago. And that's pretty much, that was his whole shtick, was about drinking too much and doing too much drugs. And then when I kind of went back and looked at like who this guy was, I was like, oh, that's kind of his thing, is like he's the, you know, drugged out hippie, not hippie, but California guy.
Yeah.
You know, California surfer, weed smoking guy. In any case, NBC made the boldest and stupidest move of the upcoming TV season by moving their hit drama, This Is Us, to Thursday. You mentioned that, Michael. At the time, you were like, dumb move, don't do it. Although, now we're saying, hey, look, there's nothing wrong with that move, except with football and the Olympics and the holidays. The show was going to be interrupted and broken up so many times, even the actors wouldn't be able to keep track of it. Now, NBC has backtracked, and they're leaving This Is Us right where it became a hit Tuesday night. You know what they said? Oh my God, is this a serialized drama? Maybe we should, you know, air 10 episodes in a row in the fall and then maybe another 10 episodes in a row in the spring. What do you think? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think, you know, you looked at it and you said, yeah, we've made a mistake. Yeah. And that's good. You got to change, you know, better than sticking to your guns and being stupid. It made no sense. You know, you could run it all in the spring, all 20 episodes together. If you have to split it up, don't do it like every two episodes and every 3 weeks on, 4 weeks off, 5 weeks on, 2 weeks off. It was crazy.
They knew they had a problem when the producers and the production company were coming to them and saying, all right, so when is the deadline for episode three? I'm a little confused. Is it now? Or is it in 4 weeks? Or is it before football? I can't figure it out. Can you just, when are we airing?
The problem is, with all those breakups, I don't know what you air in that slot other than some reality or game show or thing that doesn't matter at all. You know, that's the problem. You know, I say this about this particular show. It's their biggest hit, so you don't want to mess with that one. But you don't want another serialized drama. You don't even want to a franchise show like a Law and Order where it's just episode. You don't even want to do that, breaking it up every week. People don't want that anymore. So I don't know what you do when you've got all these interruptions. It's a big problem.
Well, what maybe, and this is just, I'm shooting from the hip
Thunderdome,
here.
Thunderdome, but it's a different network.
Thunderdome, yeah. What if you took Megyn Kelly's show and reran it during that time period?
Well, reruns are dead. Nobody wants reruns. That's
okay.
The whole problem.
All right.
Yeah. But, well, you know, it would be better to have a news magazine show on that's unserialized. But yeah, Thursday is the biggest, most profitable night of the week. You want to sort of have your big guns there.
New York City movie buffs long knew the pleasure of poring over the archives at Movie Star News, a hole-in-the-wall store bursting with film posters and publicity stills. I loved that store as a teenager. That was like, going in there, it was like a treasure trove. Unfortunately, they went out of business a few years ago, and now their stock is up for auction in Los Angeles. The sale takes place over 3 days, starting on June 26th. The archive includes more than 1 million items, and yet the auction is not devoted to all of it, or even a part of it. In fact, the entire warehouse-sized collection is just item number 444. Its estimated price? Somewhere between $220, which I can afford, by the way. I think I could actually buy that whole warehouse, and $350,000, which means I can't. Pity it can't be snapped up for the Academy Archive. Someone get Spielberg on the phone. You know, for $350,000, you know, he could just buy it and sort it out later. Big deal or big whoop?
That was actually $220,000.
Oh.
Was the low estimate, not $220.
I'm out.
Otherwise, yeah. Right now, we're talking about a quarter of still. If it was $220, we wouldn't be able to slice it up that much. We need bitcoins in order to figure out how much of a slice it was. It's not a big deal, but it is a shame if somebody like the Lincoln Center Archives or the Academy Archives couldn't keep it together, because I'm sure it's worth a lot more as a whole than it will be when it's chopped up.
Yeah, you know, what was interesting about Movie Star News is you could always go in there and find a script, or you could go in there and find a poster to Raiders of the Lost Ark 10 years after the movie was in theaters. You could find, you know, all the posters for that film, all the different variations. They would have one or two of them. Sometimes they were expensive. Sometimes they were like, you know, $10 or $15. But you could always find the stills from the press kits, and it was just such a great store.
Yeah, the auction looks really fun. I mean, they've got an R2-D2 that's up for sale and a bunch of other stuff. So there's a lot of cool Hollywood memorabilia in that mess.
But I love the way you call it a hole-in-the-wall store. No, you went into this store, and you literally thought you had walked into an episode of Hoarders.
You had to turn sideways.
Yeah, pretty much. Okay, well, CBS We've got a lot of news about news on this episode, I've noticed. CBS unceremoniously dumped their evening news anchor, Scott Pelley. He's returning full-time to 60 Minutes, and Anthony Mason is the temporary replacement. The evening news show's ratings leaped ahead for a while when Pelley first stepped in. His agent, Ari Emanuel, negotiated a new contract right at the peak of success when ratings were still rising. Pelley was also key on 60 Minutes, and he was respected as a journalist just in general. His pay finally came closer to his rivals when prior to that it was significantly lower. Unfortunately for CBS, it was the peak. Ratings never matched his rivals. Now they're dipping and Pelley is out. Big deal, a big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal. Any change at an evening news network, as much as that doesn't matter the way it used to, is a big deal because it's still a signature show for the networks and it still does bring in money. I was fascinated by the fact that Ari Emanuel probably created a lot of bad blood between Pelley and the head of CBS News. That's when you negotiate. When your ratings are rising and you're the hot ticket in town, that's when you want your agent to say, hey, we need to make a new deal here because my guy's getting pennies on the dollar compared to the other anchors. And that was the case. The problem was that he didn't continue to deliver, that it turned out to be the peak rather than the beginnings of something newer and even better. So they were ugly negotiations, apparently. Pelley talked about that just now. And I think that's it's come back to bite him here. Because it's a bizarre, the way they dumped him was so, usually you have somebody new in place or something's happened or you're ready. This was just like, get your stuff out of here. Yeah. It was really ugly.
You see the name on that door? Can you take that with you? Just slide the name tag on. Yeah. It happens just not that often, okay? The number one song on the Billboard charts is Despacito, and Dios mío, it's not in English. It's credit to Daddy Yankee and Luis Fonsi's popularity, the song itself, and to a smaller degree, a guest appearance by Justin Bieber. About once every 2 years, a song entirely in another language, or more often a song in both English and another language, tops the charts. La Bamba is an obvious example, though Gloria Estefan pulled off the feat with the ballad Oye mi canto? Is that how you pronounce that? Oye mi canto.
Yeah.
She did that more recently, and other tracks include novelty numbers like Rock Me Amadeus and La Macarena. I love the way you responded in Spanish, by the way, to that question. So I'm expecting a full Spanish answer to, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Sí, vaya cosa.
It was a complete answer, and it's just really short.
I got nothing else. What I'm always fascinated by is to remember that it happens so little in North America, but it happens all over the world.
Well,
because
yeah.
They hear songs in another language. Most people in the world don't speak English, and yet English pop songs are topping the charts all over the world. So you hear them in Italy and France and Germany and Spain, as well as their local songs. And I find that really interesting. When you think about world music, it's all world music. And people listen to songs in languages they don't necessarily understand. They learn them phonetically, and they learn online now more easily than ever what they mean and what they're saying in their own language. And I'm glad to see it happen in the U.S., and I wish it happened more often.
Yeah, every year in Cannes, when they have movies that take place in the modern day, and there's a song, sometimes the song is in the language of whatever, the language of the film is. But very often the music is, an English pop song. And I've always noted that, like, wow, yeah, no matter where you are in the world, I guess English as a kind of the language of pop, at least for now, is prevalent.
That's right. I remember seeing The Sun's Room, an Italian film at Cannes, a lovely story about a family grieving over their child who had died. And a couple key moments in the film, they were playing pretty obscure Bill Eno songs. Which were just lovely, and it was so cool to hear them in that. But I didn't even track at the time or really think about, it's not even in Italian. But it's true.
The Sun's Room, I still have not seen that movie. I tried to see it in Cannes in 2001, when it won the Palme d'Or, by the way. This is a Nanni Moretti film. I just couldn't, I got shut out of screenings. And then the last day screening, I was still going to the entire festival back then. On the last day, they repeat all the competition films. Michael, you might remember that. They still do it today. But they purposefully would not have prints, because this was in the days of 35mm prints, they would not have prints with subtitles so that only, the native speakers would come. They'd have French subtitles, but not English subtitles.
Yeah, that's changed since then.
Yeah, because now, of course, there's no excuse to not have English subtitles.
Yeah, well, you know, I haven't been to Cannes in years, so I have to glory in the days gone by. So I have to reference stuff from 15 years ago.
Well, well, you know, also I noticed even on English films, they will have English subtitles. And here's why. Many people who don't speak French fluently will kind of know a bit of English, okay? So they can read the English, but they can't understand the English when it's being spoken. So they can read the English subtitles to keep up with the story.
Or it might be Welsh or Irish or British, so it helps when or Appalachian, so it helps when dealing with accents.
True. That's true as well.
I used to watch The Wire with subtitles on.
Yeah, with that show, I could understand it. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. I don't know where you want to start on this one, Michael.
Well, let's start with Tidal. Let's start with the Jay-Z music streaming service. They're having trouble, aren't they?
Well, I was going to say, why start with them? I've never started at all.
That's right. Well, they're still in a bit of turmoil. Somehow, Jay-Z got Sprint to invest $200 million in Tidal a little while ago. I'm not sure how. But he still can't find a CEO to stay in place, now, at least not for more than a minute. They've had three CEOs in 2 years. They've lost their third one now. Now they're looking for a fourth. And, you know, talk about a troubled subscription music service. There's a lot out there. I don't know what they would think they could offer that others don't have, but it's not working.
Well, think about it. If you're an executive, okay, of a CEO level, if you're a C-suite executive level, why would you kind of go into a situation that you think, hey, you know what? There is room for a number two. There's even room for a number three, okay? But gosh, there's really not room for number six, okay? So why would you take on that role?
Right, yeah, but I think, you know, it's not working, and I think most likely they're probably just blaming the exec. You know, that's the easiest person. It's not working, fire the exec. Get rid of them, or they quit out of frustration and annoyance. So not good news for Tidal, but there is some good news in streaming music for other companies like Apple.
Yeah, so Apple, I guess right now, today, they're having their Worldwide Developer Conference, so they announced a whole bunch of iMacs, and then a whole bunch of MacBook Pros, and then I don't know what else.
I just bought a MacBook Pro. I thought it was new.
Well, you know, the second you buy that computer, Michael, literally, they're releasing another computer. You can almost guarantee it. It's obsolete the minute you've made the decision to purchase the computer.
Not if it's a desktop.
Well, that's true. Lately, these days, Apple's like, oh yeah, computers. I guess maybe we should probably make some of those, right? And here's why, okay? Here's why they're not releasing as many Macs and MacBooks. Because iPhones account for 60% of Apple's revenue. iPads and Macintosh computers, whether it's iMacs or the MacBook Pro, they account for 20%. So all that hardware, that you know, kind of desktop hardware and laptop hardware and iPads, that's 20%. Services, okay? This is why we're talking about this story. Services account for 13% of their revenue, but that is up 20% over last year, and Apple has a goal of doubling that segment's revenue by 2020. And you might say, well, what are services? Okay, services for Apple include iTunes, iBooks, the App Store, as well as all those revenues from Apple Music, Apple Pay, all the money Google pays to Apple for, you know, using its search engine on the Safari browser. They don't break up any of the segments, so you have no idea how much iTunes is making versus iBooks. But,
or the watch.
Well, that's true too.
Which is the second biggest watch in the world, by the way.
Right, but that's part of their hardware initiative, not services. That said, services is the fastest growing part of Apple's business right now.
That's right. So last week or the week before, CBS mentioned how they make more money owning a TV show than they do from broadcasting it. They make more money on the back end than they do on the front end. And that's a big change when they have to own their shows. We've seen Amazon. Obviously, they have their website and they sell products and they get their razor-thin margins on it. But they're making more and more money from their cloud hosting services and all the backroom stuff they provide for other websites and for individuals who want stuff in the cloud. That's a huge segment of their business, and it gets bigger all the time. And now Apple is saying, you know what? Content and services, rather than hardware, that's where our future is, or that's where the big growth is going to come from. And it's going to be more dependable, perhaps, than iPhones, as people don't replace their iPhones every year anymore.
Right.
So they're saying, this is where we want to invest our money. We're going to make this grow. Apple Music has just been launched and is doing quite well, and that's what's going to keep getting bigger.
Right now, I guess the estimate for the content business is $15 billion in net revenue for 2016, which is 7% of its total revenues, of the company's entire revenues. But last,
so if they double it, it could be like 15%.
Right. Well, now, last quarter alone, the revenue for content was $8 billion in the March quarter. And just to give you some perspective, that is as large as some of these big conglomerates like an NBC or a Comcast. It's not bigger than Time Warner or Disney, but it is bigger than CBS, okay? That quarterly revenue is about double the quarterly income of CBS.
Right. So they have also done this by without investing in original content too much. They have a few penny ante stuff, but they haven't done that really. But now they're still sitting there on a pile of cash and they're saying, should we create TV shows? Should we create movies? Should we create more content? That's the next step. You know, they're offering the services like Apple Music and iBook and iTunes. And now the question is, how much more do they invest in original content? They could become a player just like Netflix and Hulu and everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. This is a company that has, I don't even know how much cash they have on hand. It's over $200 billion though, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they could buy 21st Century Fox. And
well, they've talked about, yeah, making a big play like that.
But of course, then if you do that, then why would Warner Brothers want to deal with you? Or why would Disney want to deal with you? So in a way, it's better for them to say, look, we'll make some of our own shows. We'll make some of our own content. We'll, you know, kind of release a bunch of albums that we pay for. But really, we're also here to not only propagate our own content, but the content of everybody else as well.
What I don't know is how much, how successful their radio station has become. They launched their radio station. It's a worldwide radio station. They've got big talent involved, lots of big artists doing standalone shows and DJs doing stuff. I'd love to get a sense of how they feel that's, what kind of audience it reaches, how they feel it moves product. But, you know, it's there and it's every once in a while they talk about the shows, but I don't hear how important it is or how it's clicking or gaining traction.
Yeah, they themselves don't kind of publicize that either.
Well, they're the only ones who could. Of course they don't. That's why we don't have any information, because they don't want to tell us.
Well, you know, radio is kind of an interesting place these days. And what radio has become is fascinating and somewhat sad at times. In fact, Rodney Bingenheimer is a name that you may not be familiar with. He is a DJ that for 40 years has had a radio show called Rodney on the Rock, because this radio show was on KROQ, which was a tiny little station in Pasadena in 1977 when he first started this show at midnight on Sunday. So Sunday into Monday morning, 12 a.m. to 2 p.m. 2 p.m.? No, 12 a.m.
2 a.m.
Basically 2 hours starting at midnight on Sunday into Monday. And this show ran for 40 years. He was kind of a mainstay in Los Angeles music, but also really the nation's music, because KROQ became this huge radio station, this huge alternative rock radio station, in part because of his work. Well,
right. It's a hugely influential name. I mean, I'm in New York and Florida, and I knew about KROQ and the artists that they broke and the music that they played. So it's been a very influential radio station way beyond its specific listenership.
Right. Well, this was a guy, Rodney Bingenheimer, who was, before they were ever known, would play on Sunday nights the Sex Pistols, the Ramones, the Runaways, Blondie, X, the Go-Go's, Black Flag, the Bengals, and the list goes on. He was actually, in a way, discovering them and playing them for the first time on the radio. And it became kind of a rite of passage if you were kind of an alternative rock or garage band. If you got played on Rodney on the Rock, that was like a big deal.
So is he just retiring or what's going on?
Well, KROQ basically is now owned by CBS. And CBS is making some cutbacks. And one of the cutbacks is Rodney. So,
oh my God.
Yeah. So they basically said, now he does not want it to be known how old he is, but he's been doing this show for 40 years. And before that, in the early 1970s, he ran a kind of a nightclub called the English Disco, Rodney Bingenheimer's English Disco. And he helped bring such acts as David Bowie and Iggy Pop into the limelight at his club, along with a lot of 70s rock excess, I might add.
Yeah. Well, so he's been a mainstay in the music industry for decades, and they're just dumping him. It's kind of like when Village Voice fired Robert Christgau. You think, wow, if Rodney on the Rock isn't safe, nobody's job is safe. You know, ESPN firing all their talent, KROQ firing Rodney on the Rock. It just feels like, my God, nobody's left. Nobody's got a job left.
Well, and a lot of people would say, hey, look, have you ever heard Rodney on the Rock? He's hardly a DJ. You know, he's not, his voice is very meek and timid, and he kind of goes wandering off in his kind of conversational style. And you go, how did he ever get a job?
But he's got great taste.
And he's like incredibly eccentric. He was invited to a recording session of Celine Dion that Phil Spector was holding. Phil Spector invited him in 1996. So he shows up with a few friends like Bob Dylan, Brian Wilson, and of all people, Cato Kaelin. Okay, the you know, O.J. Simpson house guest. He was so eccentric that there was a 2003 documentary titled Mayor of the Sunset Strip. That was kind of his nickname, Mayor of the Sunset Strip, because he was constantly, he eats at Cantor's Deli in Los Angeles every night. And when I worked at Film Stew, it was in Hollywood, basically Hollywood and Vine, the only place to eat was this Denny's. And I would see him there every day, day after day. And I thought, who is that weird guy in the corner? I see him here all the time. And finally, somebody told me, hey, you know Rodney on the Rock? That's Rodney. And I thought, oh my gosh, okay. And he's this little thin waif of a guy with spiky hair. And you know what? He's just, he is who he is, and everybody loves him.
Well, it's a shame he'll be gone, but that's the way it happens, I guess. He's gone from the radio, and actor Peter Salas is gone from the earth. While we were starting our show, I got an email from our in-house movie critic, Aaron Rich, who let me know that actor Peter Salas had died.
Oh, no way.
He died at 96, and he's famous, I think, for most young people for doing the voice of Wallace, that cheese lover in the Wallace and Gromit series, which has won multiple Oscars, multiple specials, multiple films all over the world, a beloved character that he brought to life. So he'll be missed. He also starred in the very long-running sitcom Last of the Summer Wine. That's a UK show, but it's played all over the world. It ran from 1973 until 2010. 37 years. It was about the hijinks of three old men in a small town. He played one of the old men. That's back in 1973, he played one of the old men. He was in his 50s when it began. So he played him into his 90s. So kind of amazing there. Yeah, very well known for that show. He delivered the last line of the series, "Did I lock the door?" So, you know, it's just nice to be able to say goodbye. 96-year-old, you can't say, oh gosh, gone too soon or anything like that. But, you know, a lovely voice and character. I wonder what this means for the future of Wallace and Gromit.
It would have been great if the last line of that show was, ooh, cheese.
Too much to ask. So it could have been. No, 2010, it could have been. You're right. So a lovely little actor with a great career, and sorry to say goodbye. And we're sorry to say goodbye to our viewers, aren't we, Sperling?
Yes, or our listeners, much like Rodney on the Rock said, is saying goodbye to his listeners. We have to say goodbye to you. And by the way, Michael, he's going to have a coffee table book of photos from the English disco, all those 70s rock stars, some interesting photos. So maybe on a future episode, it might be one of your book filter picks.
Now I'll be paying attention for it.
And in fact, if you want to find out whether Rodney Bingenheimer's coffee table book becomes one of Michael's book filter picks, you know what? You don't want to miss an episode of Showbiz Sandbox, so you should subscribe in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Usually you can find our show there. If you can't, let us know, and we'll make sure it gets posted and listed there. You can rate and review the show in those podcast directories. It does help us out when you do that. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. If you can't find our show on any one of those podcast aggregators, call, write, let us know. You can reach out to us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle. Or you can find us on Facebook. If you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up and you can like us there. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a website, showbizsandbox.com. They have a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Gilt has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's great. Now I can't stop singing lamacarena.com.
I see, a reference to our story earlier in the program. Hey, you know what? If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to thehuffingtonpost.com? Or, you know what? You can always find all of his work on michaelgiltz.com. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, Play nice.